Welcome once again to our 16th in a series on the Da Vinci Code deciphered, or the Da Vinci Code trying to say where it has made some very, very serious errors under the guise of being accurate history. And my guest, of course, as usual, who's been doing such a fine job, in my opinion, on this program, is Ron Eldred, who is the teacher at John Paul II Catholic High. He teaches world history and American history, teaches religion, teaches government, has been such a mainstay of our programs here at WHOJ 91.9. So welcome back once again, Ron, and I'm your host, as usual, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar, where the shamrock is at the intersection of the streets. Ron, we've spent several sessions discussing the sacred feminine and its role in both modern paganism and even ancient paganism. We did this to try and refute what some Dan Brown's claims in the Da Vinci Code, that Jesus Christ came not to save the world from sin, but to restore the sacred feminine. And it's one of those startling reversals against traditional understanding of Jesus' role. And it's made with kind of a frontal statement. And it reminds me once again of what the architect of the Nazi code, Goebbels, had always said in trying to convince the German people of the superiority of the Nazi race and pagan religion, that if you want people to believe something, make the lie so big that people would say, oh, well, they wouldn't make up something that big if it wasn't true, wouldn't say it. But it seems to me that Dan Brown just off the cuff constantly makes statements that we're trying to show have no basis in accurate history. So I believe that we hopefully decisively refuted this claim that Jesus didn't come as his main purpose to restore the sacred feminine, but that he came as a savior to deliver us, liberate us from our sins, self-centeredness, selfishness, egomania that we all have to wrestle with. We've kind of finished paganism. Gnosticism has also come up numerous times, and it's a major theme in the Da Vinci Code. So could we talk something about Gnosticism, which runs through history, 20 centuries, always coming up sometimes in this form or that form?
Yes, I think you're right. We just simply can't understand the Da Vinci Code without an understanding of this term Gnosticism. In fact, there's been a whole, we were talking about this earlier, several of us, there's been a lot of programs on television here in the last, just seemed like the last year. It's been a big proliferation of programs on the Discovery Channel and the National Geographic Channel and the History Channel and others on the Gnosticism and these so-called Gnostic Gospels. And on there were so many programs on the Da Vinci Code, and where they talk about these Gnostic Gospels. So what we're going to try to do here is shed some light on this topic. It's a very complex topic, Gnosticism is. The term Gnosticism derives from the Greek gnosis, which means knowledge. Sometimes it's called secret knowledge, but it just simply means knowledge. The term has been broadly used to characterize anyone who seeks secret knowledge, usually meaning knowledge of an experiential or some kind of a mystical nature. However, this can be very confusing, the use of the term, because there have been so many groups over the centuries who have been seekers of secret knowledge. A meeting of scholars was held several years ago at Messina, Italy, to clarify the meaning of the term. And if I recall right, it was recommended that to avoid confusion, the term Gnosticism should be used only to in reference to certain groups that existed during the second to the fifth centuries.
Mm.
While the term Gnostic be used in reference to any group or persons who seek secret knowledge. And so the word Gnosticism, they would recommend not use it to apply to groups today, let's say, or persons today who are seeking secret knowledge, but only apply it to the genuine Gnostics of the second to the fifth centuries. And those are the ones we're primarily going to look at, although we will make some reference to Gnosticism today, because there is some connection, not a direct connection, but some connection.
Okay. Well, wasn't Gnosticism, secret knowledge, one of the major heresies of the early centuries of Christianity?
Yes.
Yes.
I think you begin to even see evidence of it in the New Testament. Scholars have identified two major schools of early Gnosticism. There was the Persian school, consisting of Manichaeism, which I believe you mentioned in one of our earlier series, and Mandeanism. And then there's a second variety called the Syrian-Egyptian school.
Now, is Manichaeism the same as Mandeanism?
No, they're entirely different.
Well, is Mandeanism the Syrian-Egyptian school?
No.
We're talking about three different...
Mandeanism and Manichaeanism would be from the Persian school.
Okay.
So there's two schools, the Persian school and then the Syrian,
all right,
Egyptian school. Those are the two schools.
All right.
Mandeanism is found in Iraq. In fact, there are even some Mandeans there now. It showed up on the news a couple of times watching it. While on the other hand, Manichaeanism, if I recall right, came from Persia itself, which would be modern-day Iran.
Okay. Well, let's say a few words then about Persian Gnosticism, or Manichaeism, which was made famous, I suppose, by Augustine's struggle.
Well, we won't say too much about that, Bran, because, as we said before, it was not nearly as important as the Syrian or the Egyptian, but there's still a few, as I said a while ago, who practiced Mandeanism in parts of southern Iraq, and then also in the province of one of the Iranian provinces of Khuzestan.
Ron, could you say a word about Persian Gnosticism?
Well, as I said a while ago, a few still practice varieties of the Persian Gnosticism, for example, Mandeanism, in parts of southern Iraq and the Iranian province, one of the Iranian provinces. Manichaeanism, which represented its own independent religious heritage, was more widespread than Mandeanism, but it's for the most part extinct today. In fact, neither of these traditions contained any overt Christian elements. St. Augustine was a practicing Manichaean until his conversion to Christianity and becoming one of its most bitter enemies afterwards, I might add, when he became a Christian. Persian Gnosticism was decidedly dualistic, heavily stressing a more definitive division between light and darkness. That's where we get this dualism, you know, light and darkness. Persian myths describe creation as a result of a competition between the realms of light, that is the immaterial or the spiritual goodness, and then darkness, which was material evil, with the ultimate object of the victory of the forces of light, or in other words, good over evil. And since this brand of Gnosticism has really little influence on Christianity, I'm not going to say anything more about it.
Okay, so you want to spend time, because this is where really the Da Vinci Code mentality comes in, on Syrian-Egyptian Gnosticism, the second big branch of Gnosticism.
Yes, I think that's the most dominant influence on Gnosticism, even in the ancient world, and certainly today. this Syrian-Egyptian strain of Gnosticism. And it derived its nature from various Platonist influences, that is, you know, from Plato. It had far more impact on Christianity. And typically it depicts creation in a series of emanations, and we're going to explain this later, which means the origination or creation of the world by a series of hierarchically descending radiations from the Godhead through intermediate stages to matter. And we're going to explain that. I'm just sort of giving a summary of it there. But not unlike the Persian school, there was a tendency in this form of Gnosticism to see material evil as an inferior force compared with immaterial goodness. And since Syrian-Egyptian Gnosticism had more of an impact on Christianity, I'll explain a little bit more about that later on. Because I don't think you can really truly understand the Da Vinci Code if you don't have some grasp of this.
All right, so basically we're saying, as even a great tendency today is that the body material is bad and the spirit, the soul, is good. And wasn't it even back to the Platonist or Plato who said that the soul is sort of imprisoned in the body and is seeking, trying to escape the prison? And that's really what Jesus came to say, the dignity of a human person is that I am body and spirit, and I'll be even that after death. I believe in the resurrection of the body, life everlasting. So when Jesus became incarnate, came into the world, he clearly wanted to demonstrate to us the awesomeness of the body-spirit unity. So we're trying to get away from the Gnostic idea that body is bad and soul is good.
I was watching a program the other night, a two-hour program on the Gospel of Judas, which they're making such a big deal out of now. It was on the National Geographic Channel and also in their magazine. They've had several articles about these Gospel of Judas. And that's the whole theme of that, is that this Manichaean or this Gnostic idea that the body is evil and the soul or the spirit is good. And Judas was really doing a great favor for Jesus when he helped, when he betrayed him, so that Jesus could be crucified, so he could be killed, so it could liberate his soul, his good soul, from his evil body. It's really quite a twist on Christianity, but we'll come back to that notion. But you can see this this kind of permeates the Da Vinci Code as well.
Okay, and so, but that's the heart of Gnosticism, that the material is evil and the spirit is good.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's. Where can we find the Gnostic writings? Are these hidden revelations? Are this hidden wisdom?
Well, not many of them have come down to us, scrolls, papyri, codices, and things of that sort. Most of them have been destroyed either by the early Christian churches or the Roman Empire when it became Christian, or, you know, just by time. And as they gradually faded out, nobody recopied them or anything like that. So most of what we knew about them came from the early church fathers.
Okay, so they dealt with them. They were they were already writing to say these things aren't Christian belief. These are way off the beam.
Yes, especially in the second century and the third centuries. You find people like Origen, Justin Martyr, Ignatius of Antioch, St. Ignatius of Antioch, Tertullian, and later on you find people like the next century, like Irenaeus. Sometimes these are referred to as the heresiarchs. These were church fathers that were fighting and struggling against these early heresies, these early Gnostic heresies. But nonetheless, these men wrote very extensively in their refutations of the Gnosticism of their time. And they would write long quotes. They would quote out long passages.
Okay.
And then turn around, of course, and refute them.
Sure.
And so that most of what we know about the Gnostics, until about 1945 or so, and we'll explain why that later, came from the writings of these early church fathers.
So the early church was early dealing with this, these fake gospels, these fake supposedly true scriptures and descriptions of Christianity. So it's nothing new to the church.
And it's like I said a while ago, although many of them were destroyed or lost over the centuries, various Gnostic texts were either hidden and later found, or in some instances preserved in the libraries of monasteries. There were, you know, a few copies that were
sure
hidden in the monastery libraries. The biggest find of Gnostic text was in 1945 that I just mentioned. This was at Nag Hammadi, Egypt. There's been several programs on TV about this in the last couple of years. But this discovery included a collection of 13 ancient codices. And by codices, I mean they were means a book rather than a scroll.
Okay.
It contained over 50 texts, various Gnostic writings. And this find includes a large number of important Gnostic scriptures, most of which were thought to have been entirely destroyed during the Christian struggle to eliminate heresy and to define orthodoxy. And included in the discovery are the Nag Hammadi discovery.
Okay.
Were the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, and the Gospel of Truth. And the discovery and translation of the Nag Hammadi library was accomplished during the 1970s and has provided impetus to a major reevaluation of early Christian history and the nature of Gnosticism by some radical scholars. For example, Elaine Pagels, whom we quoted quite a bit a couple of sessions ago in her Gnostic Gospels, which Dan Brown relies on so heavily, and the work of the Jesus Seminar are direct results of this discovery.
Okay, so what was discovered at Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1945 and translated pretty thoroughly and became well known in 1970 were the same copies or the books that the early church fathers were fighting against back in the second century.
And had quoted out long
and
passages.
And had quoted long passages.
Yes.
So we know they knew about these things.
Yes, they knew about these
things. Okay, so the discoveries in one sense were very new to some people, but they certainly weren't new to the early writers of the church who were dealing with these very heresies.
That's true.
Okay. All right, don't we Catholics usually refer to these texts as Apocrypha, and it gets a little confusing because that word is used in several different ways.
And we'll try to clarify that. By Apocrypha is meant spurious, that is, not authentic or genuine, as opposed to authentic, canonical, or inspired writings found in the New Testament. As St. Luke tells us in the beginning of his gospel, there were many who sought to tell the story of Jesus and his teachings before him, but apparently he didn't think that they had done a very good job because he sat down and was writing his own gospel. And many of these accounts we would call apocryphal, that Luke refers to. However, not all of them were written by Gnostics or by other heretics. A few of these texts were Orthodox. None of them have come down to us, I don't believe. There were a few, such as the Didache, for example. The Didache, I think in Greek that means to teach or teaching.
Teachings.
It was the teachings of Jesus. In fact, some have thought that the Didache was sort of a catechism of the apostles. And then there was Shepherd of Hermes. These were very orthodox writings, and there were others that circulated around at the time, and they were used for sermons, you know, by early Catholic Christians. They were used in liturgies. They were, you know, used to base creeds on and things of that sort. And there were a lot of other things written by well-meaning Christians who simply wanted to fill in the details about the life of the baby or the boy Jesus, or the Virgin Mary, and may have not as such contained any heresies, any false or wrong teaching, incorrect doctrine or anything, but still not necessarily
kind
true.
Of imaginative.
Imaginative things, you know.
How Jesus would make little clay birds and touch them, and they would
perform
fly
miracles.
Away.
He would do miracles and things
all
like that.
Of, and the church never accepted those as really the authentic gospels.
Well, these stories contain fantastic stories, or these texts contain fantastic stories about the little Jesus or the little Mary or Mary or whatever. Nice little stories, and a lot of these actually got into the lore, Christian lore, and in fact, I understand that in a lot of the cathedrals of Europe, there's lots of stained glass windows and lots of paintings depicting a lot of these apocryphal stories, and they're nice and they're harmless, and a lot of times there may be a basis of truth in them.
Sure.
But it's another thing when you start talking about the heresies, when you start talking about the Gnostic writings. That's a very, very different thing.
Okay, now let me just stop a moment. We're going to use the word apocrypha, and we've already used it about books in the scripture. Well, we're going to talk about that. But for instance, traditionally before the new translations, we called the last book in the Bible the Apocalypse, instead of what we call it now, the Book of Revelation. And the Apocalypse was made into a famous movie about Vietnam, the chaos that was coming into the world through this terrible war. And so I suppose most Americans know about the word apocalypse now from that famous movie about Vietnam, or earlier Catholics would know about Apocalypse as the last book of the Bible, now called the Book of Revelation. But we're going to go on and talk about a little more technical terms that the Apocrypha, for technically for biblical students, mean certain authentic books that we have as Catholics. I believe there's seven plus parts of Esther and Daniel. But the Protestants in the break in 1517 didn't accept those seven books, but I think now that in almost every Bible I've seen, they're putting them in the back and calling them the Apocrypha, or some people would say these belong in the Scriptures. So let's talk a little bit about, as Catholics, we have different meaning for Apocrypha when we're talking about the Bible than do our Protestant brothers and sisters.
Yes, by Apocrypha, we Catholics would mean books other than the canonical books.
The ones that the church accepted authentically that belonging to the Bible.
Those are the canonical books, yes.
Okay. So
they consider those to be the inspired books. Apocrypha books would be those that would not be inspired. In fact, some of them, but not all of them, would be heretical books. Books written by Gnostics and other heretics. But on the other hand, there were some Apocrypha that probably had a lot of good information in it, a lot of accurate, true information in it, but for various reasons or another, the church decided not to include them in the canon.
All right, now, if you will, because I myself get confused about this, when we Catholics talk about the Apocrypha books of the Old Testament, we're including, and I'd ask you to name them, these books as belonging to the inspired Word of God, but the Protestants did not accept at the time of the Protest Reformation. So could you name those
books?
Well,
traditionally, Protestants mean by Apocrypha certain Old Testament books contained in the Catholic Bible, but not contained in theirs, such as 1 and 2, 1st and 2nd Esdras, Wisdom, Ecclesiasticus, Tobit, Judith, Baruch, and 1st and 2nd Maccabees, and parts of Esther and Daniel.
Okay.
What Protestants call the Apocrypha, Catholics call the deuterocanonical books.
Okay.
Which just simply means the second canon.
But that we would accept them as inspired books in the Old Testament?
Oh, yeah. If you pick up a Catholic Bible, you'll see that those are included in the Old Testament. They're not stuck in the back somewhere like some Protestants do in some Protestant Bibles.
I've always told in information class that as Catholics, it's harder to carry the Bible because we've got more books in the Bible than Protestants have in the Bible.
Well, the Catholics would total up 46, I believe, in the Old Testament. And the Protestants is 39 or something like that, if I recall right. And if they are included in the in their Bible, these others that I just named a while ago, they would be in the back under what they call the Apocrypha. But on the other hand, Catholics call that the deuterocanonical books, and they are actually included up in the Old Testament section.
Well, I would just say to our listeners, if this is confusing to you, it is confusing if we don't really kind of focus on it. So perhaps the easiest thing to do or to say is that as Catholics, we have seven more books, at least, in the Old Testament than Protestants do. But I think we could also go on to say there isn't anything in those seven books that is a major a doctrinal teaching, except perhaps about the Jewish custom of praying for the dead.
Yes, in Maccabees.
In the book of Maccabees, that we continued, of course, for 2,000 years in the church.
We're working on a series on interpreting the Bible, and in that we hope to explain the history of that, so we can explain why this is
how that came about.
Yeah, it'd be far beyond our purpose and take at least a half hour session to explain that the history of that. So we'll do that later.
All right, now let's talk about Apocrypha are non-genuine or inauthentic books that the church never accepted for the New Testament. And you have several there listed. I'm surprised at the number you got listed there.
Well, Dan Brown claims there's 80.
Okay.
Probably closer, I think I heard Elaine Pagels the other day on a program, I believe it was she, named there was probably more like 15 or 20. And I'll name a few of them. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of the Egyptians, the Gospel of the Hebrews, the Secret Book of James, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, infancy Gospel of James, the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. But then there were also a lot of Acts, the Acts of Peter, the Acts of John, the Acts of Paul, the Acts of Andrew, and many others. There were Apocrypha. There were quite a few Apocrypha, there were epistles. There were quite a few epistles, the Epistle of the Apostles, the Epistle of Barnabas, the Apocalypse of Peter. There were a lot of these Gnostic writings. And as I said before, there were many other Apocryphal writings, and not all these texts are Gnostic writings, but nonetheless, they are heretical.
Our time is coming to a close, Ron. So we've been talking about the Gnostic Gospels, these unauthentic or spurious Gospels that the church never did accept and excluded. And the early church fathers even wrote serious papers against them, saying why they weren't valid, they weren't true. So the next round, we're going to take a few of those Gnostic or inauthentic Gospels that have been surfacing, as you mentioned, so much on television recently, Gospel of Judas, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and talk about that Dan Brown used those as the very sources for his novel, The Da Vinci Code. So thanks so much, and we'd like to say to our listeners, may God bless you always and in always.